This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Sister Thea Bowman is remembered for her dedication to civil rights and celebration of the Black community within the Catholic Church. She was the first African-American member of the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration in La Crosse and continued to set new firsts within the Catholic Church until her death in 1990. Recently, the FSPA joined Bowman's home diocese in Jackson, Mississippi, in calling on the church to recognize Bowman. And last month, the U.S. Catholic bishops voted unanimously to open an investigation to consider her for sainthood. Joining us today to talk about this effort are Sister Eileen McKenzie, president of the FSPA, Sister Rochelle Petrosky, a member of the organization and a former colleague of Bowman's, and Dan Johnson Wilmot, a music professor at Viterbo University and a former colleague of Bowman. So the U.S. bishops, as I mentioned, voted in November to open the cause for canonization. Sister Eileen, I know you were there. I mean, what was that event like?
Oh, it was overwhelming in many ways. It was a sacred time. You could tell that the diocese itself took a lot of pride and meaning in what Thea's life and her ministry and her spirit offered to the church. And there were people from all over the diocese, but also in all areas, I would say, where Thea had had a touch. So there were students from schools that were named after Thea, you know, after her death. So Sister Thea Bowman's schools are in many places, and there were students who were 7 and 8 years old who were there from Sister Thea Bowman's schools. There were students of Sister Thea Bowman who were just active in their communities in so many different ways, particularly in civil rights areas. There were people in the church pews who knew her, who grew up with her, and there were people who were there, who were just inspired by her and kind of, I would say, mentored by her in many ways, such as Father Maurice Nutt, who is one of the promoters of her cause.
Yeah, and just for a little bit of background for people not familiar with the Catholic Church or the canonization process, mm-hmm. you know, I wonder if you could talk about how common is it for the Catholic Church to open an investigation like this?
Yeah. It's not very common. and the gift of saints in the Catholic Church is that it holds up members of the church community who offer hope and sanctity and witness to the Christian values that the church espouses, and particularly those messages that are needed considering the signs of the times. And so Sister Thea's unanimous approval from the bishops was actually at the same time that the bishops have declared again that racism is a sin, and they have a whole pastoral letter on the sin of racism and the way that it's infecting our society, and the impact of that in violence and systemic injustice is something for us to be really considering and for us to be praying about and for us to take take some movement in. And so that Sister Thea Bowman's life is being held up to scrutiny during this time formally within the Catholic Church is very meaningful and not common.
I definitely want to dig into more of the message behind this later in the hour or in the half hour. But, you know, first I just want to talk about kind of who Sister Thea was. And I wonder if Sister Rochelle, you can talk a little bit about, you know, where Sister Thea came from and when she joined the FSPA.
Okay. She joined the community, and I reflect on that now because when she came, she was the only Black person in community. And for me, observing her as this little white girl, I was a little older than she, but I really had never seen a Black person. We did not have Black people in La Crosse, people of color. And so I think of her coming, you know, from the distance, coming from Canton, Mississippi, just revved up to be a Franciscan sister. And coming here, and we really, you know, I don't think we really understood. I didn't. That, you know, we just served food, and she had to eat what we ate, which was very uncommon to her, I think, in many ways. She followed our schedules, And she was always wanting to be, you know, out having a good time and enjoying people, even though she was very structured in her own manner of seeking to become a religious woman. It's hard to say that, you know, here's Thea going to be a saint, because she was like so many of us in ways like, you know, we wanted to be prayerful and beautiful and godlike, but we all had our own tricks, and she had a whole pocket full of tricks to try on people. you know, so we rubbed elbows with her every day, but she was that true blue kind of person. You always knew exactly what she was thinking, and if you didn't know it, she would tell you, Rochelle, this is what we're going to do now, not what you're thinking. Okay. As she entered community, she was really a gift to us, and I think that's what I would say about that experience. As she went to Viterbo, at that time she also had TB, so she was in a sanitarium for like two, three years. And that put her, you know, in another whole place where she did not know anybody.
What impacts do you think she had on the La Crosse community?
Well, she had a lot, but it took time. She was going to be teaching at one of the schools in La Crosse, and when the people in the parish found out that she was black, they were not willing to have her in their school. You know, and Thea was probably one of the best teachers we've ever had in education. And so I admire our president at that time, was Sister Patricia Alden. So she went to the parish meeting and said, well, you know, if you choose not to have Sister Thea, then that's fine. We will find another placement for her, but you will need to hire a layperson in her place. So they reneged and had her, and of course she was dearly loved and respected. But that's kind of what La Crosse was all about. We were not warm and opening to people of other cultures. We still have a problem with that, but we certainly were not then.
Yeah, Sister Eileen, I wonder if, how you think, you know, Sister Thea kind of helped open up maybe the La Crosse community to, changing their ideas and confronting some of that racism.
Yeah, I think that, you know, some of the stories that Sister Rochelle has just shared, at a very personal level, who she was as a person and just how she interacted and the systemic racism that she had to endure within the Catholic Church with that and within our educational system, within our little cross civic community. Those are all these personal pieces. And then I think I never knew Sister Thea. I've only known her story and her history and what I've learned from what she's left in this legacy, in a sense. And what I can see is that she, just through by being who she was, she made inroads, she made an impression, she made, you know, these small circles, I would say, of influence. And then she had a time in her life where she left La Crosse. That's where she got her doctorate at Catholic University. And at that point, I think she also went through this coming to know her Black Catholic identity and having freedom in a place that was much more integrated, a society that, you know, to discover that, to just own it. And then coming back to La Crosse and teaching at Viterbo gave her a different platform to share that. And she shared that, I think, again in her personal realm from the stories that I've heard, but she also shared it through her teaching, through her witnessing, through her speaking engagements. And she started to become you know, a larger spokesperson for the Black Catholic community, for Black Catholic women religious, and that was in La Crosse, but that just kind of spiraled out to other parts of the nation.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about Sister Thea Bowman, a deceased member of the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration, who's being considered for sainthood within the Catholic Church. We're here with Sister Eileen McKenzie and Sister Rochelle Petrosky from the FSPA, and a former colleague of Bowman, Professor Dan Johnson Wilmot from Viterbo University. As you mentioned, Sister Eileen, you know, Bowman taught at Viterbo University, and I believe that's how you knew her, Dan. And I wonder if you could share, you know, what she was like as a professor.
Well, I think the students that had her for their English classes will say that she was really tough. She expected, I think her philosophy about learning was that if you were sitting in class and you were totally comfortable, you probably were not learning anything. That learning involved a little bit of feeling uncomfortable. And I often use that in my teaching to explain to my students that if you're learning new material, that's going to be, you might be frightened about new material. It might you know, shake you up a bit. And I think that kind of personifies Thea as I knew her. You can't talk about Thea without saying what a beautiful voice she had and how she was unashamed about singing anywhere. So I don't remember a talk that she gave where she didn't sing. And they were always religious songs, although she knew some others as well. And some of those were from her culture in Canton, Mississippi. And it's a culture I think she was really proud of. She called herself an old folks child, and that was pretty plain. I think when she was at Viterbo, when I knew her, I think the things that she did at Viterbo were to bring a group of African-American students on campus, and they had a house, actually, that they all lived in that was in where the parking lot is now for the Fine Arts Center. But they lived there. She established the Hallelujah Singers, which was an African-American choral group that sang primarily spirituals. So she had an impact on Viterbo. And I know when she left Viterbo because her parents were really ill. Her parents were elderly. She moved back to Canton. And I think it was especially at that time where she started to get involved in her own culture and with her people in Canton and in Jackson that her evangelical side, and I'll call it that, I hope I'm not mischaracterization. The sisters will correct me if I'm speaking something that's not true. But I think that's where she began that charismatic evangelical side. And I remember I was a good friend of hers, and Thea affectionately called me her little brother because she didn't have any brothers and sisters. And so I became the white sheep of the family. I use that. I hope it's not disrespectful. But we became good friends, and we both sang. We're very different from one another. Thea characterized herself as a rowdy, and I'm rowdy, so she shook things up, I think, like St. Francis, perhaps. And I think that she, if you want to see an example of that kind of activity, if you watch the video where Mike Wallace, the infamous interviewer, interviewed her, and it took her about three attempts, but she finally got him to say "Black is beautiful" on during the interview. Yes. And I understand that Mike Wallace was teased by all of his colleagues over that because she turned the tables on him on an interview, and that didn't happen to him very often. So that's the kind of work that she did. She could take a criticism and turn it around. She's very smart, very clever. Mm-hmm. Always a little step ahead of, she could lead, but always in a, what I would say a positive way. Everything about her was wanting to be positive and inclusive. So those are things that I learned and felt from her, and she is an amazing woman. I brought a copy of some of her music here, but some of her favorite things were "Go Tell It on the Mountain," "Mary Had a Baby," and she has some other songs like "Old Time Religion." And if you ever saw her with a group of students singing "Old Time Religion," there was always movement. There was always a face that reflected the text. And I directed the concert choir at that time at Viterbo, and we would often, when Thea was in town, she would have them sing. And boy, a half an hour rehearsal from her was about everything music had to do with, especially the face. And that's where she would really get after our students. You have to show emotion. You have to feel the music. You need to live the music.
Sister Rochelle, I wonder if you also have memories of her speaking engagements and just really sharing this gift of music she had.
I want to tell a story because he reminded me of that. When we were at Catholic University, and many of our sisters had gone there for years and years, and FSPA was known because there were so many of us. But we went to the first time Sister Thea was there. There were five of FSPAs there at the time. And so we went. They were going to have a gathering at night. They called it a hoot nanny in those days. So we were all sitting on the grass. You know, people were singing. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere in our minds, Thea jumps up and goes up to the front. We thought, what is she going to say or do? Because we really didn't know that she was this big singer at that time. So she got up in front, and she starts talking about Her grandmother was a hog caller, and her grandfather was a slave, and she was from Mississippi, and she was going to do some singing with them. So she got the whole group just completely in a second, just riled up in singing, and that's the first time that I had seen her get up and get the group going, total control. And then later, I went to Canton many times, and spent time with her mom and dad. Her mom was an English major, a teacher, and her father was a physician. And at that time, Canton, Mississippi was very segregated, so her father's office was in the black area. And if we went anywhere with Thea, even as a sister when we were in Catholic University, she would kind of crouch in the back so that nobody would see her with the white people. We did that all the time. We had to be that kind of protector. But, you know, she just had that sense of music and drawing people together at any time, and she certainly, you know, portrayed it that evening at the Hootenanny. We were just like, oh, Thea. It was a joy being with her those years.
Sister Eileen, you started talking earlier about how, you know, Bowman's cause for canonization at this time is really sending a message from the Catholic Church. And I wonder if you could dig more into, you know, what that looks like, especially here in FSBA in the work that you guys are doing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. If you look at Thea's writings and any of the videos that are out here and you hear the stories, she does have this theme of total embodiment of spirit. You know, it was in her face. She lived it. She talked about how, you know, God gave us these bodies and they're to embody the spirit. So just this total embodiment and inclusivity that she was about bringing everyone to the table. If something is affecting someone, then they should be at the table to help make the decision. She spoke so much about in her heritage how the family was such a core, you know, piece of not only her formation but her culture. How, and it's not just the one little nuclear family. It's like she called herself an old folks child. You know, that, I mean, all of her aunts and uncles and grandmothers and grandfathers and things. So she really is holding these values of family and extended family and reaching out to other people who look different than we do and engaging them because they're gifts. She was always about the dignity of the person. Whoever you are, she would, you know, I am black, I am beautiful. She would say, I'm a child of God. You are a child of God. You might be white, you might be brown. But she would say, we are all dignified because we are children of God. And FSPA is echoing this, and we're amplifying this. We in fact just recently had our General Assembly, and we declared a revolution of goodness in which goodness needs to be claimed. It's something that's happening. There are so many things in our world that are happening. There's so much bad news, whether it's real news or fake news, whatever news it is, we need to focus on the good news, is what we would say. And some of what Thea's bringing us to in the goodness of each and every person, especially difference, the rich diversity that we have and how that just brings so much beauty and meaning to life. It's not to fear. We don't need to fear it. We don't need to push it away. We don't need to build a wall to protect ourselves around it. We need to engage it because they're gifts from God. And in that engagement, we get to be a little uncomfortable, as Dan was sharing. I mean, that message that she said about education, if you're not uncomfortable, you're probably not learning things. And so the sisters are engaging in some uncomfortable conversations about, all right, we are pretty white and we're pretty privileged, and what does that mean in this world? What is Thea calling us to kind of take a look at? And not only Thea, but what is our entire society calling us to look at in just who we are and how we influence others, often subconsciously or unconsciously? What norms do we have set up that we don't really even think twice about because we're not challenged by people who are different in asking the questions? So those are some areas that that we're reflecting on, just how this is happening in the larger church, how it's happening with FSPA, what it means for the La Crosse community, what it means in southwestern Wisconsin. We believe that whatever it is good, and it's unfolding, and so we're discerning how to best engage it and share the goodness of it.
Yeah, Dan, I mean, what do you think the greater La Crosse community can draw from Sister Thea's message and her life? I mean, you know, how can we apply those things to the greater community here?
Well, I think awareness is the first part of that. If we're unaware of our neighbors and of people who need things, people who are sick, people who are struggling with problems of addiction and those kinds of things, I think that is what the La Crosse community could learn from Thea's life and her work. Take a look at our friends. Who are our friends? Thea was very proud of her Asian friends, of her African American friends, her Native American friends. She had friends in every community and went sought them out and made sure that she had friends who represented different cultures. And we have other cultures in our own community, the Hmong culture. We have a growing African American culture in La Crosse. And so there are, I think maybe it's Thea's influence on us that these things are changing and that we are more aware now, I think, of our diversity, and I suppose that would be also religious diversity, and so she had friends in many cultures and churches and faiths and was proud of it.
Yeah, Sister Rochelle, how do you think Sister Thea has shaped the FSPA and the Catholic community here in La Crosse?
I think Sister Thea certainly has opened our eyes to people of other cultures. She has looked at the reality of, as Sister Eileen talked about, goodness. She always saw the good in others. Even though she'd say, oh, those poor folk, they don't know what they're doing, she was very conscious of who she was and what she wanted to promote in the world, just in her own being. I look at her and I say, it's amazing that she's going to be a saint. I mean, we could have said that years ago, but on the other hand, we would say, Thea, a saint? I mean, she was always out in the forefront doing things that some of us were afraid to do or say. So she truly is a leader, and I think the FSPAs are very proud of her.
And Sister Eileen, so this is only the first step in the canonization process, and I wonder if you could kind of fill us in of what happens next.
Well, right now they've opened the process. She was declared a servant of God in the springtime, and so now they are actually doing a series of studying her life, and that includes a historical commission as well as a theological commission. I'm not really sure what the timeline of that is. Everyone's a little curious about that, and there's so much diversity in the timeline throughout the Catholic Church, but we are are in the beginning stages, and at the stage where if everything goes well and they've studied these aspects of her life and she has been deemed to be beatified, then that will take place, and then it moves into a second phase where she would be canonized. I don't know as much about the intricacies of this because it is a very, very... you know, it's a well thought out and a very intricate process. A lot of people are involved in it. The Diocese of Jackson has taken the lead on it, and the promoter is one of her students, you know, Father Maurice Nutt. And we are walking in solidarity with them at each step of the way. But the theologians and the historians who are involved in this really don't have much of a personal history with Thea so that there can be objectivity in it. You hear our stories, and we have a personal meaning around this. And the church wants to hold up this, I guess, review of her life and be sure that it's it can be embraced by people all over, and not just the people who knew her.
Sister Eileen McKenzie is president of the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. She's here with us today to talk about Sister Thea Bowman, a deceased member of the FSPA who's currently being considered for sainthood within the Catholic Church. Also joining us have been Sister Rochelle Petrosky, a member of FSPA, and Dan Johnson Wilmont, a music professor at Viterbo University and a former colleague of Bowman. Today's outro music is an archival recording of Sister Thea Bowman. Coming up, we'll talk with the rabbi from La Crosse about the current climate for Jews in the La Crosse community. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Hanukkah is this week, the annual Jewish holiday commemorating the rededication of the temple in Jerusalem. In light of the holiday, we're joined by Rabbi Saul Prombaum, leader of the Sons of Abraham congregation in La Crosse, to talk about the local Jewish community and the current climate for Jews in the Cooley region, Wisconsin, and the nation. Rabbi, I wonder if you could start by explaining kind of what Hanukkah celebrates.
Well, okay. I think I can put Hanukkah into a nutshell. I think it was best summed up by the comedian Alan King. I think he was the original who said, they fought us, we won, let's eat. But actually, what it is, it's a commemoration of an event that took place in the 2nd century BCE in a climate where Hellenism had taken over the region after the death of Alexander the Great. And so you have basically these two huge Hellenic superpowers. You have Syria and you have Egypt. And at the time of the Hanukkah story, Syria was in control of what we call the Land of Israel. And what Hanukkah is was the attempt to curry favor with the local Syrian king. That is, it was a civil war where those who were in favor of Hellenism asked for the intervention of the Syrian king to come and support them against the traditionalists, what today one would call the Orthodox types. And so it was the Orthodox priesthood that won out against their more liberal co-religionists, And it's about 20, this is 20 years into a war that's been going on for a very long time. And they, 3 months to the day since the closing of the temple 3 years prior, they decided that not to create a new holiday, they decided they were going to celebrate the last holiday season-wise that could have been celebrated then, which was the Feast of Booths, Sukkot. And so if you look at the Book of Maccabees, you'll see palm fronds and citrons. The idea was to get back to business as usual. It wasn't for another 300 years that Hanukkah as a liberation holiday, basically one side wins, and it's the side that actually, believe it or not, makes it possible for Judaism to emerge and for Christianity to come into being, and possibly Islam as well. So if you don't have these hardliners then fighting against assimilation, you don't have the rest of the Western religious tradition as we know it.
And so what traditions are associated with the eight-day festival nowadays?
Ever since they decided how to celebrate Hanukkah, it has always involved preferably an oil lamp, but you know, those of us who use candles, it's just okay, to light a candle each night, that is to increase in holiness by increasing the number of lights. This is based on a legend that comes out of this battle, that there was only one little flask of kosher certified oil in the temple they found when they had cleaned it out, and that it would take another 8 days to get more. And somehow that one little flask of oil was like the little train that could. It just kept on burning. And so what's the message, of course, is it doesn't take much light to dispel darkness. And so every night at this time of year when everything is getting shorter and shorter, days are getting shorter. It's nice to have this festival of light and the other ones that we have around us too.
And so, are there going to be any special events in the La Crosse area among your congregation to mark the holiday?
Okay, we always have an annual Hanukkah dinner, so that's coming up this weekend, and that's pretty much what we do, because Hanukkah is primarily a home celebration. In fact, we're asking people to bring their what we call Chanukiah. So I can explain something. The word menorah in Hebrew means lamp. It's a generic term. And so if you have a lamp that has seven branches, which we don't use since the destruction of the temple in the 70, is if you don't have that kind of menorah, you use what's called a Chanukiah, that is a special menorah for Hanukkah that has eight lights, for this 8 day celebration, as if they were lighting at home, so that's what we're gonna do. It's a great time for candle sales, Hope.
So I wonder if you could share a little bit about your congregation here in La Crosse. You know, how many people belong to the congregation, and kind of what's the region that you serve?
Sure. Well, we serve about 70 miles around, and that's a very interesting reach, because it takes us to the fringe of at least a couple of established Jewish communities, one of them being Rochester, Minnesota. One of them being Postville, Iowa, which means that if you live in Winona, say, you have to make a decision where you're going to go to synagogue if you're a synagogue-going person. You could just as easily say go to Rochester at that point as coming here. We've always been around the same size, somewhere in the mid-40s in terms of membership units. We call it, just has always been that way. We've been on Main Street in our new building since 1948. And from 1905 until 1948, the congregation met in a house at 11th and Badger Streets, right near the studio here. And that house is no longer there. The address is still there. But I want you to know that what we call the Sons of Abraham is not the first Jewish community here. We actually have a presence going back to the 1840s. And the I believe he was the second mayor of La Crosse, John Levy, was of the Jewish faith. He was British. Most of the Jews here at that time were middle-class German Jews. They probably didn't get along with each other.
How does, you know, maybe that history influence the Jewish community today?
Well, it's a good question. I'll tell you what most influences any community, and that's how the highways work. If I-90 had been in existence at the time that our synagogue was being formed, I do not know that we'd have a permanent synagogue in La Crosse, because it would be very easy to hook up with 94 and head to the Twin Cities. It used to be that the only way to get to La Crosse from Chicago was by Highway 16, which is still there. And, you know, it would be hard to imagine that one would take 16, but that's La Crosse was a destination on Highway 16. So we're very grateful. So it's the road, it's the traffic patterns that affect where a community will be. Now, if John Levy is purported to have been the first white settler on Prairie La Crosse, then it meant that there were traders here, and so there are other people coming here in different ways, probably primarily by the river.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Rabbi Saul Prombaum of La Crosse about this week's Hanukkah celebration and the local Jewish community. And so, you know, Rabbi Saul, how would you characterize the current climate for Jews in the La Crosse community? I mean, is this a kind of a welcoming community that recognizes, you know, the people of Jewish faith here?
This is a great community. And I want to tell you what I have always taught kids in our religious school, which is if you are not comfortable with who you are, people pick that up. And it makes, whether they know it or not, makes them uncomfortable and it makes them not know what to do with you. So if you have a strong identity, people with strong identities respect other people that have strong identities, even if it's not theirs. So it's usually people who are insecure that have trouble meeting other people. So if you're proud of being Jewish, and people know that you're a Jewish, they respect you. And we've always had tremendous respect here. It's the nature of the community. I'll tell you I think it was almost spring of 94 when our cemetery was desiccated by spray paint. And we got phone calls from all over the area of people wanting to come and clean the stones. That was a very beautiful moment. Knowing what kind of support, and that this is pretty much a zero tolerance community. We are still working, you know, with some groups that have, you know, come here from other places, but we have to make a place for everybody, and that's the La Crosse tradition.
And what do you think the current climate is like for, you know, people of the Jewish faith in the United States in general? We've seen a few, incidents I want to touch on, and, you know, I just wonder kind of how you would characterize that.
Well, I'll tell you, if you take a giant step back, and I'm going to take an even bigger step back than I think you would expect I would, but I want to go back to, I think it was 1985, I think, when this poor guy who was off his meds went into St. Patrick's Church on Alaska, you know, one weekday morning, and murdered the priest and two lay people on the altar. And this sent a reverberation through the United States everywhere, including ghetto communities, saying nobody goes into a church and shoots people up, you know, like that. And it was a very tragic situation of a local fellow who had gotten off of his meds that he needed very, very badly. So It was at that time that I had to wonder, well, do I want to be in the synagogue if it's unlocked? You know, do I just want to have people walking in? And so there's always a feeling that when you're a public place, it doesn't have to be gun violence. It could be just people walking in for whatever reason. And I would say that we're certainly goosed up right now because of all of these shootings that are happening in different places against different populations, churches included, and places where people who are gay and lesbian and genderqueer, they're known to hang out, and they are persecuted. You also have someone in Las Vegas that nobody even knew was a violent person taking his guns and taking out so many people. So we live in a climate where it's not just Jews who are feeling under siege, but I would say everybody. I think Philadelphia, given that it was Squirrel Hill, which was a very nice, still is a very nice neighborhood. It just is one of those neighborhoods around which a city grew, and it came as a shock. And there are even people here in La Crosse that would hate to see us, shut down so tightly that people couldn't visit in our synagogue. But this is the way it's gone with schools, churches. You name it. There is security everywhere now, very similar to what they have in Europe, sadly, and have had it for a long time.
Yeah, you bring up the shooting that took place at a synagogue in Pittsburgh in the Squirrel Hill neighborhood just a little over a month ago, where a gunman killed 11 people. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that event has impacted the Jewish community here in La Crosse.
People want to feel safe. They want to come to synagogue, and but if. I have to say it. If somebody wants to hurt you, they will find a way to do it. And I always tell my people that the security begins between the ears, and you have to be mindful of who belongs and who doesn't belong. And if they don't belong, you don't automatically assume that there's somebody who wants to hurt you. You know, this is the very delicate balance. We need to keep humanity alive in society, because otherwise we'll walk around with our faces in our smartphones and never connect anymore.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, how do you, as a faith leader, as someone leading a congregation, how do you walk that line between being welcoming, being open to the public, and also, keeping your congregation safe? I'm sure this is what a lot of faith leaders are asking themselves.
Well, sure. So let me give you an example. You may know that most people who are not in your congregation, if they have a reason to being there, so let's say they're a UWL student taking a sociology course and they have to come, they usually call me during the week, which means I look for them to come, and even I have them come to the synagogue before Saturday so that they can see what the place feels like. So when they come in, they just know what to do. So I call it the rabbi's list. And also we have people who come in who typically know somebody in the congregation. And if they're a guest of the member of the congregation, that member should be there, and they should escort their guests in and welcome them and have us welcome them. And so it's, we have a locked door policy now. It's not that hard to get in, but it is locked. It wasn't always that way.
That's Rabbi Saul Prombaum here with us today to talk about recent events impacting the Jewish community in light of this week's Hanukkah celebration. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. I also wanted to touch on an event that has recently happened a little bit closer to home. Wisconsin's been in the national news in the last month when a photo surfaced on social media of a group of Baraboo High School students doing what appears to be a Nazi salute.
Yeah, and I think the operative word is what appears to be. That is, I would be more convinced that it was if everybody in the picture was doing it. But it seemed like off to the side, you know, you have a bunch of boys who are just, you know, gooning around. And I say, you know, these kids didn't post the picture. It was a grown-up that my understanding that posted the picture. It got posted at the wrong time. This was around Pittsburgh time. And you have everybody reacting the way social media reacts today, which is to shame and to bully. The things that we do not want in society are now being done very handily by social media. Everybody weighs in, a lot of condemnation. The kids never had a chance to talk about it. Never had a chance to redeem themselves, if that's what it really was. How are they going to get a break? This is where I come from on that issue. I could say yes, it is terrible. If it's actually reflective of white supremacist or a neo-Nazi belief, we have to nip it in the bud. But I'm not so sure in that case that is what was going on, and I need more information.
How do you think? I don't know, what are your thoughts on the way that the local officials, the school district has handled this issue? Do you think there has been enough consideration of, you know, what actually happened?
Well, here's the thing. If you're in a position of leadership, you really have to take the measure of your domain. You know, so for example, if you're a high school principal, you actually work in your school, and you also work as part of the school district, and you have to listen to as much information as possible, and then you have to act in accordance with what makes people feel safe, even if one goes to the side of overreaction.
How can the Baraboo community, but really the larger community in Wisconsin who, you know, really reacted to that photo, how can we move forward? You know, what do we need to learn from this event and take forward?
Well, actually, one of the things that we need to take forward is something that actually is something good that has come out of social media, which is vigilance. The question is, what do you do with what you see and what you hear? And I think that you have to first and foremost not put things up that other people are going to misinterpret. Now, that means you're going to be putting up a lot of skim milk. But that's the way it's going to be for a while. We don't, as a society, much have a sense of humor. We, you know, because of political correctness, I assume that someone who doesn't know me and is referring to me wants to hurt me, but which isn't necessarily true. And so I think that we're in the pendulum has swung so far one way. It has to come the other way. It doesn't mean that you'll let your guard down. It just means take a deep breath and ask, is this really what is going on? Do you want to perpetuate the culture of fear that is hysteria? Or do you want to really dig in and find out what's going on?
You bring up kind of the divisive culture that we have right now, the combative culture, some might call it, in the U.S. And I wonder what your thoughts are, the role of faith leaders in, you know, helping us kind of mend some of these divisions and you know, move forward from this kind of divisive nature we have.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question because I think if you had, you know, pastors, priests, rabbis come in, imams, I think that each would tell you that their setting is different, that what their congregation is looking for from them is either faith leadership or someone who has their finger on the pulse of current events, national news. Those, by the way, tend to be larger synagogues where the rabbis who have been there for a long time, they can get away with saying certain things because their congregations are used to them. Other places, they do not want their spiritual leaders talking about certain issues in a society they come there to pray. I would not have lasted these 36 plus years if I did not set myself up against those who would maybe take a stronger line on most everything. That is, I create a space in my congregation so that people can express their opinions safely and not take a position from the pulpit that would automatically alienate half of my congregation.
We've been talking with Rabbi Saul Prombaum, leader of La Crosse's Sons of Abraham congregation, about recent events impacting the Jewish community in light of this week's Hanukkah celebration. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, including our conversation about a local nun being considered for sainthood in the Catholic Church, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.